So the book of Psalms, a long time ago, very long time ago now, we introduced the book of Psalms. And at that time, we talked about how it was the hymn book. We have hymn books in our pews here, but the Israelites had their hymn book. They only had one. They didn't have lots of different ones. But in one way, it was similar to our hymn books, it could be, in that it went through lots of revisions. So it's not like someone sat down or a lot of different authors sat down and wrote the Psalms, and they were all collected, and boom, there was the book of Psalms. The book of Psalms was developed over at least 500 years, growing and going through different revisions. So, you know, you have five books within the Psalter. Originally, it would have been maybe one of those books. And if we look at the text, sometimes there are clues in the text about what some of those earlier editions of the Psalter might have looked like. Now, we can't know for sure, but it seems like Psalm 9, which we all, if we were here last week, we looked at Psalm 9, and Psalm 10, which we're going to look at this morning, were originally composed by David as a single psalm. Single psalm. There's reasons for that. I'll just briefly mention them. There's signs that the two psalms together might have originally been a complete acrostic. So Psalms 9 and 10 would have been each section beginning with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet, starting with 9 verse 1, going to chapter 10 in the last verse, which would have made it one psalm, an acrostic psalm. In the first three books of the Psalms, that's the first 89 chapters, there's only four psalms that don't have a title. You know all those titles that most of us don't probably read at the beginning of the Psalms? To the choir master, according to the Gittith, the Psalm of David. There's only four psalms that don't have that. And chapter 10 is one of them. In light of what we see elsewhere, that could be a sign that chapter 10 originally did have a title. It was Psalm 9's title. So that would have been a single psalm. In a number of old, ancient manuscripts of the Psalter, and in the Greek translation of the Psalms, Psalms 9 and 10 are one chapter. They actually are one chapter, which tells you why the chapter numbers are all messed up between the Greek and the Hebrew, or our English translations. Finally, as we're going to see this morning, 9 and 10 have a lot of themes and words in common. That's why I'm convinced that even if they weren't originally one psalm, 9 and 10, if they weren't originally one psalm, they were placed together in the Psalter because they were meant to be read and interpreted together. You can't rightly understand Psalm 9 unless you're reading Psalm 10 with it. Likewise, you can't rightly understand Psalm 10. You can't be prepared for it unless you've read Psalm 9. Sometimes we read the Psalms and it's like we read them isolated. This is the psalm, it's standalone. And it is. But yet, sometimes we're meant to read the psalms around it for its context. So, we remember, though, after all that, that Psalms 9 and 10 have come to us in your handout in the final edition of the Psalter, as two separate psalms. Why would that be? Especially if it was originally one, why would that be? One reason for this, as we're about to see, is that the mood in Psalm 10 feels significantly different than the mood in Psalm 9. That's going to be important for us this morning. We have moods, don't we? What mood are you in today, Mike? We could get a lot of different answers to that, probably. The psalmists often found themselves in different moods, and their psalms expressed that. And I think that's one reason, probably, that this psalm, if it was originally one, was separated into two by inspired editors under the direction of the king, because there was a mood in one, and there was a mood in another. They said, what does that mean? So last week, David, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at Psalm 9 a little more than briefly, but still kind of briefly. We're going to rush through and then come to Psalm 10 to set the stage. Last week, David was afflicted. He was distressed. He was even close to death at the hands of those who hated him. And yet, he begins the psalm with these words. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will recount all of your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. So David comes to God as one who is in covenant with him. David knows God not just generically as God, and I want to encourage you. Think about how you know God. You don't just know him generically as God. That's not how you know him. It's impossible to know him that way. Impossible. We know him as the one who has given himself to us in a relationship of committed and everlasting love. That's worth a whole nother sermon today. And so for David, because of that, even in his deepest distress, there is still reason for wholehearted praise. There will always be reason for wholehearted praise. This being glad and exulting in the Lord, that's his covenant name. That's not a way of forgetting our troubles. And I just love that about the Bible, about the Psalms. We're going to talk about this in a minute. It is real. It's a big deal today to be real. Right? We're going to talk about that. But it is real in the right sense of the word. It means in the sense of it, we don't forget our troubles or pretend they're not there. This being glad in the Lord is the way I strengthen my faith and my trust in the Lord. Being glad strengthens my trust so that in my affliction and in my distress, I can actually cry out all the more earnestly. If you haven't learned to exult in the Lord, you cannot cry out to him as earnestly as you need to in distress. So often, again, as we said last week, we're going along, and then the stress comes, and we go crying out to the Lord. We don't know what that looks like or really is. Unless we have learned ultimately to exult in the Lord. After determining to recount the wonderful deeds of the Lord, David does that. We read in verses 3 to 6, when my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before your presence. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne giving righteous judgment. You have rebuked the nations. You have made the wicked perish. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy came to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. Remember, this is supposed to be a prayer that we make our own. Our own. So how do we praise God for the enemy coming to an end in everlasting ruins, their cities being rooted out, and the very memory of them perishing? I don't honestly think we would have much of a problem with that, except for the fact that we live in affluent, happy, at ease America. I think that's why we don't know what to do with these psalms. But to start with, we have to remember this is a first of all, a song or prayer of the king. I just want to drill that into us. When the king prays those words, he has a right to pray those words that we don't have by ourselves. By myself, I have no right to pray these words. But the king, by himself, has a right to pray them. He's praying as one, though, in whom I am represented. The king represents me, and so when the king prays these words, the people pray these words along with him. There is a fellowship that we have with Christ our King when we pray these words with him. There's a fellowship that we can have with him. So the king's enemies are now our enemies. The king's victories are our victories. And the king's joy is our joy. We also have to remember who the enemy is. And this is important. We're not talking about the Russians now. Okay? or the Chinese or the Germans. The enemy, the nations, are simply all the wicked and the ungodly who hate God. They're all the wicked and the ungodly who cruelly oppress God's people. In light of that, I want to ask you, this is a simple question, but shouldn't we be able to rejoice and be glad in God's righteous judgments? See, just because we're under the new covenant now doesn't mean those weren't still righteous judgments. Righteous. Shouldn't we be able to sing with David, with Christ our King, knowing that these are the things God has actually done in history. He did this. His people rejoiced. So should we. You have rebuked the nations. You have made the wicked perish. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy came to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. But the Lord sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for justice. He judges the world with righteousness. He judges the peoples with uprightness. The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed. He is a stronghold in times of trouble. And those who know your name put their trust in you, for you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sometimes, unless we can see the direct and immediate relevance of something to me, we tune out. I want to warn you, this has no direct, immediate, obvious, blatant relevance to you. It has huge relevance to you, but not like we often crave. So here we go. David reminds himself that the Lord who sat on his throne in the past, giving righteous judgment, still sits on the throne today, judging righteously, because he sits enthroned forever. And if all that mattered was we just said something about God, it would be enough. And yet we know it has something to do with us, so we go on to say this. The Lord's judgments are his wonderful deeds on behalf of his covenant people, that's us, to defend them, to rescue them, to deliver them when they're oppressed and mistreated by wicked people who are more powerful than they are. And so we too confess with the psalmist. And again, this is the test of the Psalms. As we talked about last week, the Psalms, you can preach them, but they're meant to be sung in the end. They're meant to be prayed in the end. And so we confess the Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Remember that. We're going to need to remember that in a moment. Now that he's recounted the wonderful deeds of the Lord, David concludes, sing praises to the Lord who sits enthroned in Zion. Tell among the peoples his deeds. For he who avenges blood is mindful of them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Okay, there's the third time now David sings of the Lord sitting on his throne. And that's the third time, too, we're reminded the Lord doesn't sit on his throne just for the sake of sitting there. If you believe he sits there, believe he sits there for a purpose and a reason. What is that purpose and reason? Always connected to his enthronement are his wonderful deeds, especially his righteous judgments on behalf of the afflicted. And what do afflicted people do? I think of the Israelites when they were in slavery in Egypt. What do? They cried out. So the Lord works on behalf of his afflicted who cry to him. Then all of a sudden, David's counting himself now among the afflicted of God's people. He's been talking about the afflicted. Now we see he is afflicted. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for my affliction. See my affliction from those who hate me. O you who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may recount all your praises. That in the gates of the daughter of Zion, I may rejoice and be glad in your salvation. So on the one hand, David says, I'm with you. I'm with all the afflicted. I'm one of you. On the other hand, David's the Lord's anointed king. Put yourself in his head. Okay, be him for a moment and realize he's not just talking about all his own affliction. He sees in his own affliction and he's concerned about all the other afflicted that he's responsible for. And so we see that the Lord's answer to David in his affliction will in the end be his answer to all of us, his afflicted people. That's why even when death appears ready to swallow David up, there seems no way of escape. David is confident the Lord will lift him up from the gates of death, because it's not just about him, it's about all of us, God's people. When Jesus went to the cross, he knew God would lift him up from the gates of death. Because he also, not only because he was the innocent Son of God, but also because he carried in himself all the afflictions of God's people, so that in him we might also be lifted up from the gates of death. That's why David goes on to sing with these words: "The nations have sunk in the pit that they made, back to the confidence in the net that they hid, their own foot has been caught. The Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. The wicked are snared in the work of their hands. The wicked shall return to Sheol. All the nations that forget God, for the needy shall not always be forgotten. And the hope of the poor shall not perish forever." Remember that there are four different Hebrew words that we have for the first time here in Psalm 9. Maybe you remember what they are. Do you remember what they are? We have for the first time the word for the oppressed. For the first time, we have the word for afflicted, or the poor. And for the first time, needy. Oppressed, afflicted, poor. It's in the context of those first that we have another first. And what's the other first word we hear in the Psalms here? It's the word for God's throne. That's the picture. Okay? The throne of the one who is to these oppressed and afflicted and needy people their covenant king. Psalm 9, verse 4, "You have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne giving righteous judgment." Verse 7, "The Lord sits forever enthroned. He has established his throne for justice." Verse 11, "Sing praises to the Lord who sits in Zion. Tell among the peoples his deeds. For he who avenges blood is mindful of them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted." And it's in that context of confidence and faith. You see the mood of Psalm 9? Yes, there's earnestness, there's crying out, but it's overall a mood of confidence and faith. King cries out to God, and all of the oppressed and all of the afflicted and all of the needy, they cry out to God in and with their king. Maybe you don't count yourself too oppressed right now or too afflicted. But just know that when the afflicted cry out to God, they don't cry out isolated by themselves. They cry out in and with Jesus Christ, their King. "Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men." That's the end of Psalm 9, but the psalmist is not finished. So, we come to Psalm 10. And right away, we notice how it feels very much like what's changed. The mood has changed. Verse 1, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" That word for trouble, that expression, times of trouble, appears only one other time in the whole entire book of Psalms, all 150 chapters. Can you guess the other place it appears? Or do you remember? Psalm 9. And what did it say in Psalm 9? In chapter 9, the psalmist confessed by faith, "The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble." That's the only other place in the whole book of Psalms we see that word or that phrase. And then in Psalm 10, the psalmist cries out, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" So this is where we come to the fact that it's very much in vogue today to be real. There's a sense in which we ought to be very wary of that word. There are some senses in which it's a good thing. The psalmist is being real here. But when being real means dishonoring God by failing to trust him, wholeheartedly, then being real is just the same thing as being sinful. And a lot of what we count for being real today is being sinful. And I thought about it. I thought, well, we are sinful for real, aren't we? So if we want to say I am being real, I see who I really am, then that's real. It's just that it's not something to boast about. It's not something to advertise. We're about being real. There's a difference, think about this, between saying to someone else, what if I said to you, why does God hide himself in times of trouble? Now, that's not bad in itself, okay? We have to maybe do a little digging there. But there is a difference between saying that and saying to you, why does my Lord hide himself in times of trouble? Did you see the difference? There's even a difference between saying to you, if I said to you, brother, sister, why does my Lord hide himself in times of trouble? And saying, crying out to God, as the psalmist does here, why, O Lord, what word does he use? The name, the covenant name for his covenant God. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Those are not the real words of a doubt that dishonors God. They are the very real words of an unshakable faith expressing itself. How do we express faith? Like this. In the midst of the utmost confusion and distress. Consider that on the cross, Jesus did not cry out. I think sometimes we're like, you know, Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And we say, that's about, I need to be real. I need to challenge God. I need to, you know, even say some things Job said and got in trouble for at the end of the book. So Jesus did not cry out on the cross, God has forsaken me. It's not what he said. Neither did he just say, why have you forsaken me? What did Jesus say? My God, why have you forsaken me? Yes, that's real. But it does not dishonor God through a lack of trust. Even as the psalmist is asking, why the Lord stands far away? I mean, why would you pray to someone who stands far away? If he's far away, can he really hear me? Now, psalmist believes that the Lord is in your handout, present with him to hear his cries. And so we learn through this is an important lesson to learn, that even when the Lord hides himself in times of trouble, it is still true that he can be at the very same time our stronghold in times of trouble. He can be both at the same time. He may be hiding himself in times of trouble, but in that very moment, he is also our stronghold in times of trouble. That is the tension. And some people, when we don't maintain that tension, we go on the side of being real in a way that dishonors God. And other people go on the side of being fake and artificial in a way that dishonors God. We need to maintain both, because it's still to him that we cry out, and it's actually in that act of crying out to God that we are not only expressing our trust, but finding him to be our stronghold. I don't just know it as a fact, I know it in the act of crying out. As one commentator writes, such questions as we have in verse 1 form the cry of a faithful believer to the Lord, the covenant God. But, now, here's the thing. None of this changes the fact that in the midst of this underlying trust, there is the definite feeling here of abandonment. And why does the psalmist feel abandoned? Well, he goes on to sing. He sings and prays and cries out to the Lord. In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. The wicked, in the pride of his face, says, he will not seek out my ways. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his foes, he puffs at them. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity. Okay, are you still feeling the different mood compared to Psalm 9? This is an important question, not just for rhetorical. Why does God seem to be hiding himself and standing far off? Why? Because it is the wicked who seem to be magnified in our eyes. Larger than life. Here are five verses all about the wicked. But what are we doing? Talking about the wicked for five verses. Is that edifying? Is that necessary? Five verses of the wicked. But what we see is that the wicked loom large. They're magnified in our eyes. We talked about this a little bit in Sunday school, but we see in some senses the wicked in the high places in America. And what happens? They loom large. I think, honestly, that's a big deal with a lot of the focus and emphasis on conspiracy theories, on always what's going on and how are the people behind the scenes controlling and doing. And the wicked are just looming large in our eyes. I'm not saying that we stick our heads in the sand. Why does it seem that God is hiding himself, standing far away? Because the wicked actually boast that he is standing far away. And then, guess what? They go about living their lives successfully on the assumption that he is. Does that do anything to you? All the thoughts of the wicked are, there is no God. And that's not a theory. They're not denying the existence of God and writing books about this. It's a practical atheism that denies the relevance of God. In other words, they admit God's there, probably, sure. But he doesn't ultimately, what word would you put there? Doesn't matter. I do wonder sometimes, you know, certainly, how do we as Christians live out a practical atheism in our lives? God is there, but his existence is irrelevant to me and to the life that I live. That's what the wicked man is telling himself every day, all day long. And you know why he can get away with telling himself that all day long? It's because God remains hidden. When we are children, when we are kids, sometimes it just made us mad when the other one got away with something. I remember the feeling, and I'm sure they felt it. As Christians, the wicked get away. The wicked boasts of the desires of his soul. His ways prosper at all times. So naturally, what's he going to do? If his ways prosper at all times, he boasts of the desires of his soul. Does God not know what they're going to do when that happens? They curse and renounce the Lord, and the pride of his face, he says the Lord will never seek out his ways. He'll always get off scot-free. He'll never be called to account. And as the days and the weeks and the months and the years and even an entire lifetime goes by, it sure seems like he must be right. Consider what we read in Psalm 9. These beautiful, lovely words. Those who know your name put their trust in you. And I'm using the sarcasm in a way that stems from a wrong perspective. Okay? These are beautiful and lovely words. Those who know your name put their trust in you. You, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. But now that's a problem for me. That's a problem. It's beautiful and lovely, but it's a problem. Because the more we are a people who truly know the Lord's name and are trusting in him and seeking after him, the more distressing it is to know that the wicked, what are they doing every day out in the world? They're cursing and renouncing the Lord's name. They're boasting in the desires of their soul, refusing to seek after the Lord, and all the while they are getting away with it. How can that be? How can they successfully live their lives built on the philosophy there is no God. And I know we might differ on whether that's successful or not, but when you're sitting in ease and comfort, you can debate about that. Do you know what the answer is? It's because there is a sense in which, to all outward appearances, it is true, there is no God. That's being real, I guess, you could say. That's what Psalmist says. Why do you hide yourself? Psalm 9, the Lord sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for judgment. Those are encouraging words, but wait a minute. As far as the wicked are concerned, the Lord's judgments are all on high, out of his sight. So here we are, the Lord sits enthroned forever. He's established his throne for judgment. And here's the wicked saying, the Lord's judgments are all on high, they're all out of my sight. And so we're reminded again that what we're talking about is not philosophical atheism, God doesn't exist. It's a practical atheism that says it doesn't matter that God exists. And it's in that sense the world is full of atheists, full. It's in this sense that we have to admit there are times when, to all outward appearances, it does seem to be true there is no God. Not practically, see, not practically, not when it matters the most. And when we're going through 1 Peter, Sue Cripple had mentioned to me Uncle Tom's Cabin. I happen to be reading Uncle Tom's Cabin right now. I tell you what, if you want to start appreciating the Psalms, just go read that book. Because that was a time when the existence of God mattered most, and when often he hid himself when it mattered most. If it's the Lord who sits enthroned forever, how can the wicked be saying in his heart, with every apparent justification for doing so, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity. Maybe we haven't yet been forced to grapple with that very real problem. This psalm has helped me to do that. Maybe we've chosen to stick our heads in the sand and pretend that this problem doesn't exist. But it does. A problem in terms of faith, of our perceptions. One day we might be forced to admit that it does, and that's why we really do need to learn now how to cry out ourselves with the psalmist. Why, O Lord? Why do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? One day we may see for ourselves the poor being pursued and hunted down by the wicked. One day we may be confronted personally with the things David describes in verses 7 to 11. His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the villages and hiding places. He murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. I mean, and this could be all forms of, this is description of all forms of oppressing, of afflicting. He lurks in ambush like a lion in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws him into his net. The helpless are crushed, sink down and fall by his might. He says in his heart, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. Here's the thing. As long as the wicked keep their wickedness to themselves, we're happy, aren't we? As long as their wickedness isn't hurting others, or maybe especially if we're honest, there's that sense, as long as their wickedness isn't hurting me, we may never feel that God is hiding himself or standing far off. But what happens when we see the wicked cruelly oppressing the innocent and the poor and the helpless, and getting away with it and never being called to account? What happens then? What happens when the innocent and the helpless and the poor is you and me? Calvin writes, it is possible that a righteous man may not check an injury which is done to a poor man before his eyes because he doesn't have the power. But this cannot be the case with respect to God, who is always armed with invincible power. If, therefore, God act as if he took no notice, it is the same as if he withdrew himself far away. So in chapter 9, remember, there were three words for the first time used: the poor, the oppressed, and the needy. Chapter 10, two of these words are repeated, poor and oppressed. But then we've got three more words that appear for the first time in the Psalms here in chapter 10. Three more. And they are the innocent, the helpless, and the fatherless. Can you see the picture that's being painted for us? Using six different words to accomplish the painting. These are all, number one, vulnerable people without any means of protecting themselves. They are defenseless and totally helpless. Maybe because they've been stripped of that power to protect themselves. There are also the innocent. They've done nothing to deserve being oppressed and afflicted and so cruelly persecuted and taken advantage of. And finally, and important in our day, not that God does not care about oppression and injustice wherever it occurs, but we saw last week that the poor in the Bible are always those who know the Lord's name. Poor is a synonym in the Bible for righteous, not just because you're poor, but because you're among the covenant people of the Lord who cry out to him. That's one part of the picture that's being painted here in these verses. The poor, the needy, the oppressed, the innocent, the helpless, the fatherless. And then, do you remember the wicked from verses 2 to 6? Remember their arrogance and their boasting and the pride of their face. And now let's put it together, okay? Let's put it together. It is before these wicked that the helpless are crushed and sink down and fall. It's by these wicked that the poor are seized and drawn into the net. It's these wicked who lie in wait in ambush to murder the innocent. And these are also the wicked who, as they're hunting down and pursuing the poor, all the while they're boasting of the desires of their soul and prospering in all their ways. These are the wicked who say in their heart, God has forgotten, he's hidden his face, he'll never see it. Which is the same thing as to say, for all practical purposes, there's no God. And now this is important. The larger the wicked loom in our minds, how large do they loom in yours? And the longer they pursue their cruel ways of oppression toward the poor and the innocent and the oppressed without any consequences at all, the more it can seem to all outward appearances that in fact there is no God. Not practically. Not at the moment when it matters the most. If that's not a problem for the Christian who confesses that God has established his throne for justice, that God sits enthroned forever, I don't know what is or could be a problem. For 10 straight verses now, the psalmist has been describing in detail all the ways, all the thoughts of the wicked. Right? 10 verses. All the miseries, all the afflictions of the poor and the innocent and the helpless. The wicked have indeed been looming large in these verses. And yet, we have to remember this whole description of the wicked, because remember we say, is this edifying? Should this be? Should we be devoting so much space to the wicked? But here's the key. This whole description of the wicked has come in the context of what? Prayer. That is massive. All along, David has been conscious in speaking these words. He has not forgotten for a single moment that he speaks these words before and in the presence of the Lord. So in the end, even though the wicked may seem to the eyes of the flesh to be larger than life, to the eyes of faith, it is always God. The faithful God who is in covenant with his people. It is always this God who looms the largest. If I could just put that in those words, who is it What is it? Who is it that looms the largest in your eyes? And it's for this reason that after all these verses, 10 verses, in spite of all the apparent evidences that there really is no God, David still goes on to pray, "Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Forget not the afflicted. Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, 'You will not seek out sin'? But you do see. For you note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and evildoer. Seek out his wickedness till you find none." Notice how bold David's prayer is. He begins with imperatives. We associate imperatives with commands. And we know he's not commanding God, but let's look at it. Here's the imperatives. Arise, O Lord. O God, lift up, imperative, your hand. Forget not the afflicted. Break, there's an imperative. Break the arm of the wicked and evildoer. Seek out his wickedness till you find none. It's as though the psalmist is calling out to the Lord, what's the word there? You know what it is. It's do something. Do something. We know those imperatives are not commands. David is not commanding the Lord to do anything. So what's the point of an imperative, do you think? What is it accomplishing here? He is expressing what he feels about the urgency and the absolute necessity of God taking action. I want to ask you, as I've asked myself this week, I want these psalms. Sometimes I think we, whatever my emotions and feelings are, I go to find a psalm to fit my emotions and my mood. But what we need to see is that the psalms are meant to shape our mood sometimes. We don't come to the psalms to find something that gives expression to me all the time. We come to the psalms to find that which shapes my mood and what I feel in a godly, God-honoring way. And so I ask us, could we use the same imperatives in our own prayers? I look at prayers like these and I think, man, my prayers are just wimpy. After the realities of verses 2 to 11, and those realities have been in realities all throughout history to the present day, after those realities, do we feel the same sense of the urgency and the absolute necessity of God taking action? Do we feel that? If we do, the psalm has done its work in us. If we don't, it has not yet done its work in us. And yet in the midst of all this, okay, here it is, at the heart of all these calls for action, there is still that unshakable, deep down conviction that even if God doesn't act now, even if he seems to be standing far away and hiding himself in times of trouble, nevertheless, he does still see all. And he does still care about all that he sees. And he does take all things into account. And he will one day act. Someday. If we can't see, we need it now. We might realize. Now I wish I would have brought Uncle Tom's Cabin. One time there was a slave crying out, even as here. And a psalm was quoted to him. And it wasn't a psalm just quoted tritely. It was a psalm that came into actual real suffering. We need these words for ourselves. It's this deep down, underlying conviction of faith that actually enables the psalmist, and I hope you can see this, It's that underlying conviction of faith that we just expressed that actually is what enables the psalmist to cry out as one who feels abandoned. That's a mouthful. That's just tough. Okay? It's as we feel this underlying conviction of faith, he does see, he does care about what he sees, he takes all things into account, he will one day act. It's that faith that enables me to cry out as someone who feels abandoned. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? And then, in turn, it's actually in the crying out to the Lord with those words that the psalmist is then further strengthened and, in your handout, fortified in faith. Even if it seems for all practical purpose that there is no God, nevertheless, we know that God will not always be silent. The hope of the afflicted shall not perish forever. Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, he will not seek out sin? But you do see, for you note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Remember how the mood seemed to change in Psalm 10? Remember, the overall mood of Psalm 9 was one of confidence and hope. Three times in Psalm 9, David sings of the Lord sitting on his throne for judgment. Okay, so far, here in Psalm 10, one word has been conspicuously lacking. The Lord sitting on his throne. We saw it three times in Psalm 9. Now for all the other words that we're still seeing, that's not here. Here in Psalm 10, the confidence of Psalm 9 has been made to pass through the crucible. Of all those harsh realities of life that seem to so powerfully contradict our faith, the confidence of Psalm 9 has been dragged and pulled through the crucible. Of all these harsh realities that seem to contradict our faith, and having passed through the crucible, and in fact, even while still being tried and tested in that fiery crucible, we find that our confidence now is just as strong as it ever was. In fact, if anything, it's even stronger now and more, I use the phrase, deeply rooted now than it ever was before. Remember how Psalm 9 ended. This is where we see beautifully how these two psalms go together. Psalm 9 ended, "Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men." And now we see that cry at the end of Psalm 9 is replaced at the end of Psalm 10 with this settled confession of faith. And I say settled because there's that sense in which we went through the uproar, we went through the turmoil, and then we came to the settledness, that confession of faith. Notice what it starts out with. The Lord is King forever and ever. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. Now, watch this. Here's the key to the whole chapter. Here at the end of chapter 10, we see again the afflicted and the fatherless and the oppressed. There they are again. The needy, the innocent, the helpless. And here again, we see the wicked. They're here too, only this time they're not called the wicked, are they? They're there, but they're not called the wicked. What are they called? What are they called? The man who is of the earth. Okay. Do you see what's happening here? This is doing this. The word for man at the end of chapter 9, here at the end of chapter 10, because there it was in chapter 9, man, men. Here it is at the end of chapter 10, man is not the usual word for man, Adam or Adam, Adam, the word for man. It's a far less common one, Enosh. And this is a word that emphasizes man's weakness, frailty, nothingness, creatureliness. I think of the words of the hymn, frail creatures of dust. We saw that word first in Psalm chapter 8, when the psalmist asked, what is man, Enosh, that you are mindful of him, and the son of man, that you care for him? Do you remember why it is that God seems to be hiding himself and standing far away? It's because the wicked are magnified in our eyes. It's because the wicked seem to us to be larger than life. They just have a way of doing that. We have a way of making them be that and appear that. But as we come to God in prayer, I think oftentimes, you know, we have these hard questions. Why does God this and why this and why that? If we'd stop asking each other that and start going to God in prayer, we find that we are answered. We may not get answers, but we'll be answered. As we cry out to God in prayer, we see more clearly that it is our covenant God who always looms larger than the wicked. And it's in this light that the wicked are finally seen to be what they really are. Frail creatures of dust, mere men who are of the earth. As we come to God in prayer, and that's the key, it's just that many times we're just too lazy maybe to do that. We don't see that. But as we come to him in prayer and cry out to him, even as we're honest with ourselves and with him about the cruel realities of life, the psalmist spent 10 verses being honest. Yet as we do this, the wicked recede into their place, and faith triumphs, and we are enabled to truly, truly for real confess with the psalmist, the Lord is King forever. The wicked shrink. The Lord is exalted in our eyes. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. So often in the Psalms, if there's an application for them, it's just trust. And as I said before, the real test of whether we've got it is whether we can sing it. So before I read this, I want to say that as I sing these psalms, I wished I could teach us the tunes and we could learn it and sing it together. But I hope you will sing it with me. I thought about standing in the back and singing, but I thought that'd be more weird and distracting than if I stood up here. But I want you to just ignore me and sing with me if you could. In your hearts. But before we sing, remember who it is who first prayed this psalm. Yes, it was David, but it was David as the type of the coming king, the Messiah, Jesus. Who it was who first prayed this psalm in the days of his own affliction and suffering at the hands of what kind of men? Wicked men, it says in Acts. Lawless men. Brothers and sisters, this is the one who now leads us in singing these same words. As he sits enthroned above, and what is he doing? Sitting enthroned above, Paul tells us, ruling and reigning until he has put all his enemies and ours under his feet. Remember Jesus. And let him teach us how to sing these words in humility and in faith. I remind us again Let the Psalms shape our mood so that we learn true trust.